Jesus the good teacher, Jesus the therapist, Jesus the giver of bling. The Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? 12 False Christs. It's written by regular guest Dr. Matt Richard. Read an excerpt at issuesetc.org or purchase Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? By calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? Well, we have talked about this long journey taken by C.S. Lewis from childhood Christianity into atheism, and then from atheism back to Christianity. And it's a long journey indeed. The last time we spoke, it was a 15-year journey for C.S. Lewis. But after he is brought back to the Christian faith, how does he reflect upon his years, his long years, as an atheist? Greetings and a welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to conclude our series, our three-part series on C.S. Lewis today. Lewis the Christian, joining us, Dr. Joel Heck. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, and author of The Issues Etc., Book of the Month, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. Dr. Heck, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. I'm delighted to be with you again.
Now that Lewis has been brought back to the Christian faith, how would you describe his reflections on his time as an atheist? What does he think about it now from the perspective of Christianity?
There are probably a lot of ways of answering that question. Certainly one of them would be that during his search, during the time that he was an atheist, he had entertained some willful blindness. He didn't really want to look at some of the evidence, but the evidence was so clear, so obvious, that he was forced to take a look at it. That would be one of many reactions that he had to it. Certainly some things he'd look at as being a bit naive or a bit posturing, particularly his letters to Arthur Greaves, his childhood friend. He thought he was being the bold, brash atheist, and he was ashamed of that later on in life.
What does he think about atheists in particular, having been one?
Well, he actually has quite a bit of respect for the atheists. So he had numerous interactions with various atheists, especially at the Socratic Club, which was an undergraduate society at Oxford University. He was the faculty sponsor and therefore the president of the society, but it was something that had been started by Stella Aldwinkel, part of the chaplaincy staff at the university. And from 1942 to 1954, he attended, though he helped to plan the meetings, he attended the meetings, he sometimes spoke at the meetings, and often ended up being the first person to respond to someone who brought an antagonistic perspective. And he had several atheists that spoke at the Socratic Club, including Anthony Flew, one of the more famous atheists of the 20th century, the philosopher C.E.M. Jode, J.B.S. Haldane, and philosopher Harry Weldon, who was a colleague of Lewis's on the Magdalen College, Oxford faculty. So he had conversations with them. He had public sessions with them. He corresponded with some of them. After he wrote the book Paralandra, which was published in 1943, Arthur Clarke, who was an atheist who had written some science fiction, wrote to him and said he didn't think that the portrayal of science and space travel was well done and was fair to him and other authors. And so he had some good interactions. He highly respected these people. He even had some friends who were atheists who were invited to go along on walking tours. He and his friends loved to take long walks in the countryside and find a place for lunch and a place for overnight stay at the end of their day. And on one occasion, I think it was A.K. Hamilton Jenkin who was invited to come along, and he said to Jenkin in a letter, "We'll respect your position." He knew Jenkin was an atheist at that point, and "We'll respect your position. You don't have to worry about being abused verbally or any other way." So He had a huge respect for them.
Was that, as far as we can tell, and you had mentioned also William Kirkpatrick, who had been one of his teachers, was that respect returned on the part of atheists? I imagine there were many who might have been disillusioned to see C.S. Lewis become a Christian.
Well, I think for the most part, I mean, one tends to treat others the way they are treated. And I think there was a good deal of respect on the other side for Lewis's position, not agreement, but respect. And same thing goes the other direction. Lewis didn't agree with them, but he had respect for their position. We talked last time about the phrase, the good atheist, that Lewis himself used. I guess the assumption is there can be a bad atheist if there can be a good atheist, but it's somewhat autobiographical that he uses that phrase and understands that the atheist is often looking at a world of pain and suffering, both in terms of the human condition as well as the natural world, and is trying to find answers to that. But perhaps that comment about willful blindness, that there is an answer, particularly in the scriptures, but typically an atheist won't be looking to the scriptures to find the answers to other questions about suffering.
He, at one point, says something to the effect of, you know, that the atheist can ignore God's presence, but never escape God's presence. What does that mean?
It goes again to that willful blindness concept. God is always there. I mean, the Christian doctrine of God's omnipresence is omnipotence, is omnipresence, is omniscience, very well known in Christian circles. So God is present everywhere. Not that we're pantheists, but that God is everywhere, and he can be, evidence of him can be seen in the beauty of nature, in the intricacy of nature, in the detail of microbiology, the inner workings of the cell, as well as in the vast distances of outer space. And, you know, like the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork, like the psalmist says. So it's there. Romans 1 talks about how everybody knows that there is a God, even if they are denying it. And Lewis was undoubtedly aware of that passage, which also explains why he talked about the willful blindness that he himself had entertained it. So they can ignore it. They can try to explain it away sometimes as a defense mechanism. I do that myself. I have defense mechanisms to try to rescue my own reputation or explain why I did something wrong or something a little bit shady. And atheists certainly aren't immune to that either.
Let's talk then about the work that C.S. Lewis produced after his conversion to Christianity. Is there a marked change in what he then is later writing and how he approaches his subject of literature?
Oh, yes, dramatic change. He talks, I don't remember exactly where he does this, but he talks about having something to write about and changing dramatically the way in which he went about writing. One of the early things that he wrote, really the first book after his conversion to Christianity, was The Pilgrim's Regress, which echoes John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, but is an explanation for why he became a Christian. So it's kind of a romantic in the sense of imaginative, a romantic explanation of the road that he traveled back to the Christian faith from his early upbringing. So that gives him subject matter to write about, and then just about everything else. In fact, at one point he said, all my books are evangelistic. So he's writing from a Christian perspective. He's doing some imaginative things like the Chronicles of Narnia, which were intended to expose children to some Christian truths so that when they met the gospel later on, if they hadn't been brought up in a Christian family, that they would be more likely to give an honest hearing to the story of Christ. Narnia was written in part with that in mind. A Mere Christianity was apologetic work, a defense of the Christian faith. The Great Divorce is a very imaginative piece about choices that human beings make for heaven or hell, for God or against God. and all kinds of articles and poems that he wrote that had a very theological, lay theology, but a very theological perspective. It was his hope that people would be drawn to the Christian faith in part by the power of the writing of Lewis himself.
Let's just talk about where would you number his greatest works? If someone says, look, I'm not familiar with C.S. Lewis's works. I know his name. I've been to bookstores where sometimes an entire shelf is filled with his works, but I've never delved into it. How would you counsel them to approach those works and work through them?
It would depend a little bit on whether they are more inclined towards the rational, logic, almost philosophical works, or the more imaginative works. But there are three things in particular that Lewis is known for. The Chronicles of Narnia and the sale of those books make up about half of what what is sold in a given year among the writings of C.S. Lewis. And my estimate is that approximately 250 million copies of his books have been published or sold since they were written. And if half of that is Chronicles of Narnia, that's 125 million copies. So it's that. It's Mere Christianity, which is very much apologetics or defense of the Christian faith, actually originating in four different series of talks over the BBC radio in the early 1940s during World War II. And the third major piece would be the Screwtape Letters, these imaginary letters from a senior devil to a junior devil on the art of temptation. We talked about that a little bit last time, too. But those would be the three main types of writings that Lewis is known for.
So what would they find in the Chronicles of Narnia? I mean, I know it's a huge subject, but what would they find there that where his Christian faith is, in his case, just beaming through?
The first of the seven is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The fact that it's been made into a movie is probably a good testimony to its impact, but it's the best-selling among the seven. And it has a story of a Christ figure, a lion, and Christ was called the Lion of Judah in Revelation 5:5. It's a Christ figure who dies and rises again, which ought to be very obvious to any Christian who's reading that, but not really obvious to a non-Christian who's reading it. So Aslan is the lion, the Christ figure of all seven books, especially the first one, and that would be the preeminent reason why they would see some Christian theology in the Chronicles of Narnia. But there's a whole lot more to it than that. There are challenges to the Christian faith. There are those that in the world of Narnia have tried to deny Aslan as a real creature, deny that there are fauns and dryads and talking animals and the like, and have somewhat similar to modern-day skeptics who say that the stories of the miracles in the Gospels, for instance, never happened. They're embellishments. So they'd find that there. They'd find a story of history from the beginning of Narnia. There's a creation story in The Magician's Nephew to a second coming in the last battle, the seventh and last of the Chronicles of Narnia. So they'd see the whole sweep of Christian history put out there in mythological form and shining through in every one of the seven Chronicles.
Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. We're concluding our three-part series on C.S. Lewis today, talking about Lewis's life and work as a Christian. Dr. Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada. He's author of the book From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt, and the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People at lutheracademy.com.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Quality, quantity, qualified. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest on this Thursday, the 1st of June. We're concluding our three-part series on C.S. Lewis. Today, Lewis and his work as a Christian. You had mentioned the Chronicles of Narnia before the break, and the other one that you had mentioned was Mere Christianity. You said an apologetic work. This is one that probably is the, for someone who's searching for something explicitly Christian, this is the one that many people are going to have contact with. How would you describe what Lewis says there in that work?
Well, he's starting with a defense of natural law, or what he calls the Tao, that the Chinese word T-A-O, Tao, the an objective standard of right and wrong. So he begins with that to explain how everybody knows that there is a God, everybody, whether they admit it or not, everybody knows that there is a standard that they must measure up to, and in fact, everybody knows that they don't measure up to it. So he's trying to create, or maybe not create, but he's trying to arouse an awareness in the British public in 1941 of their need for a savior. So that's largely what happens in the first book. Then he explains what Christians believe, how Christians behave. He gets into morality, Christian behavior in the third book. And then in the last book, he actually deals with the doctrine of the Trinity, believe it or not, in a way that's fairly engaging and gets into some of the more difficult doctrines of Christian faith and does it in a winsome way that he's so well known for.
And I'm curious about another work, and that's Surprised by Joy, which essentially tells the story that we've been telling, but from Lewis's personal perspective.
Yes, that's his autobiography. He published that book in 1955. It's subtitled The Shape of My Early Life, so it really tells the story of his early upbringing, his adoption of atheism, and then his journey back to the Christian faith, and basically ends with the story of his conversion to Christianity, which is in 1931, and then doesn't continue beyond that. One would wish that he wrote a sequel to that that would cover the years from 1931 to the end or near the end of his life, but he did not do that. It's one of the two books of Lewis that I've read that I didn't like the first time I read it. And one of the reasons for that is the fact that he spends almost a third of the book complaining about the various schools that he had to attend, especially as a young boy in the elementary school ages, and sort of venting talking about the problems that he had with that. But in the midst of this, he's trying to tell the story of his conversion back to Christianity, and ends up being a very, very powerful story that appeals both to the logic or the reason and also to the imagination and how he came back to the Christian faith.
You had mentioned several times this Screwtape Letters and these fictional correspondence between demons, especially regarding a particular Christian. Why are those, beyond just the fascinating context that he sets forth there, that format, why are those important to read?
Well, they help us to understand temptation from the other side. We always look at temptation from our side. As a Christian, we think about how we can fight against temptation, and sometimes it's good to think about how the devil goes about tempting us. We're not really focusing in a particular area of our lives quite so much as Satan might be focusing on, and some of the strategy he's using, some of the gradual wearing down of our resistance in certain areas of our lives. And the Screwtape Letters, there being 31 of them, address all different kinds of temptation and some of the strategies that, as Lewis looked at how he had been tempted and sometimes succumbed, sometimes not, he tried to present that as though it were a positive strategy of Satan or one of his tempters to get a person to sin initially, but ultimately to try to drag that person down to hell. So we can learn a little bit about temptation, learn a little bit about our own way of thinking and some of the strategies used against them, and then learn how to fight temptation, particularly the way that Jesus did with the use of Scripture.
Dr. Heck, can you please talk a little bit about some of Lewis's teachings where we as confessional Lutherans would disagree with him?
Oh, certainly. Probably the easiest one and the most obvious one is his adoption of a belief in purgatory. He believed in this idea of that is biblical, that we grow in the Christian faith and we gradually try to place all aspects of our lives under the will of God and the redemptive power of Christ. He thought that gradual improvement, and it's some improvement and some slipping back, so we never really accomplished that in this lifetime, and he thought that improvement was going to happen in the next life, and felt that the idea of purging or being cleansed of all the negative aspects of human nature needed to continue and would continue in the next life. So he had that idea that would continue after this life is over. His description of law and gospel is at times very, very good. There's a passage in one of his essays entitled God on the Dock where he talks about needing to receive the unwelcome diagnosis, that is the diagnosis that we are sinful, before we can hear and receive and believe the remedy, which is the gospel of forgiveness. So at times he's very lucid and clear in terms of law and gospel, and at other times he mixes law and gospel. He talks in Mere Christianity, for instance, about the life of good works and our faith in Christ as being two blades of a scissors. He says some of the people that read his individual chapters in Mere Christianity as they were prepared for the radio, some of them wanted more emphasis on good works and some wanted more emphasis on faith, and he thought it was just a matter of seeing good works and faith working together like the two blades of a scissors work together in order to accomplish their task, and Lutherans wouldn't be comfortable with that. We need to hold to the preeminence of faith and see the life of good works as a response to the gospel and not something that's co-equal or cooperative with the life of faith. So those would be the two major ways in which Lutherans would disagree with Lewis.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas. He's visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Canada, and he's author of the new book, From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis. This book is available from Concordia Publishing House, a very well-researched story told of C.S. Lewis's journey from atheism to Christianity. You can find out more about this book right there at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for From Atheism to Christianity by Dr. Joel Heck. Dr. Heck, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
In the next hour of Issues Etc., we'll listen to Dr. Carl Fekencher's presentation, Making the Case for Law and Gospel Preaching, from the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour 2 in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the divine service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.